welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, July 24th. I'm your reader, Alan Frederick-Hill. Here's a look at what I'll be reading today. First, I'll take a look at the weather, then the mini editorial, and then front page stories and inside stories of local interest. About 20 minutes after the hour, I'll read letters to the editor, if there are any. Don't think so today. Might be. Then at 30 minutes past the hour, I'll read the obituaries. After that, it'll be feature stories, sports, and other stories as time allows. First, here's the weather and then the mini editorial. Well, it's going to be a scorcher both today and tomorrow. Highs are forecast for 92 and 93, and that might be on the lean side. It's going to be south winds, 10 to 20 miles per hour and 12 to 25 tomorrow. Lows overnight, very warm, 75 and 74. Finally, cools down just a little bit on Sunday with a thunderstorm possibility, but still 85, 85, and 83 for Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Today's record high was actually 108 degrees. That was set in 1940, and the low was 48, and that was set in 1905. The sun rose this morning at 6:10 a.m. It'll set at 8:53 tomorrow, 6:11 a.m. for the rise, and 8:52 for the set. So we lose 2 minutes of daylight between yesterday, between today and tomorrow. Well, here's the mini editorial, and this comes from Jerry Eaton of Sioux City, who's a frequent contributor, and he has this question. I'd like to ask all of President Trump's supporters who are so dismissive of the seriousness of this pandemic and the very real health concerns because of it, why is it that the president himself and everyone around him are getting tested at least once a day? If he gets the virus, or one of them gets it and continues to work sick, no big deal, right? That, again, from Jerry Eaton of Sioux City. The only item of local interest on the front page this morning is a picture of a big, heavy piece of equipment, which is tearing down the pit, as it's known. Demolition workers take a bite out of the auditorium and gymnasium space at the Bishop Pelham Catholic High School's former school building in Sioux City yesterday. The gym area was known as the pit. Well, here's another lead story from the front page of the Journal. It's not necessarily local, but it is of interest. Iowa universities forecast big tuition losses. Iowa's three public universities expect to take a $53 million hit this budget year from tuition freezes and enrollment declines, and incur even more losses from cuts in state appropriations and research activity. In all, the universities project to generate $65.4 million less this budget year than last year due to the COVID-19-driven losses. The anticipated enrollment drops, coupled with an earlier decision to freeze tuition rates, is expected to shrink income by $14.8 million at the University of Iowa, $33.4 million at Iowa State, and $4.8 million at the University of Northern Iowa. The three institutions also must split an $8 million cut in state appropriations, divided about 40-40-20 between the campuses, with UI and ISU each losing $3.2 million in state support, and the smaller UNI losing $1.5 million. The reductions approved by lawmakers affect every special purpose unit across the campuses, except the UI-based state hygienic lab, which received a $525,000 boost in the budget year that just ended for its work processing COVID-19 tests. Although the lab was spared state budget cuts in the new budget that began July 1st, it's not getting any increase either. In outlining their new budgets, each university highlighted the pandemic that's created unprecedented challenges across their campuses, which essentially shut down in mid-March, forcing instruction online. In looking to reopen in-person classes this fall, the campuses expect significant costs in providing enough protective gear, sanitization supplies, physical barriers, and cleaning services. Due to the tens of millions each campus already is expected to lose from the COVID-19, the schools have launched cost-cutting measures that include layoffs, furloughs, salary reductions, and curtailed programs. University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld has volunteered a 50% pay cut from his $590,000 base pay for the rest of the year, amounting to a one-time savings of $270,000. Iowa State President Wendy Winterstein is taking a 10% cut for the budget year, amounting to about $60,000. And University of Iowa, University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook is taking an 11.8% cut to his $357,000 salary, which is about $42,000. Nook also will take a 50% cut in deferred compensation. The other presidents have not announced changes in their deferred compensation plans, which are due for 2023 payouts of $2.33 million to Harold and over $1 million to Winterstein. In other cuts, other cost-cutting measures underway across the universities include 5% pay cuts for all vice presidents at the University of Northern Iowa. The University of Iowa is phasing out funding for Hancher Auditorium, requiring the venue to become self-sufficient, imposing hiring and salary freezes, and laying off instructors in some units. The university will continue to use the budget model to identify, evaluate, and possibly discontinue or close activities in which state resources are no longer sufficient to support those functions, according to a UI report to the Board of Regents. Scarce resources will continue to be directed to student success, research, and economic development programs. At Iowa State, the administration is shaving 2% from its employee retirement match, temporarily freezing most renovation and capital projects, and requiring vice president or presidential approval to fill vacancies, in addition to across-the-board budget reductions. Iowa State also is rolling out a voluntary retirement incentive available to about 1,200 faculty and staff. Savings will depend on the number of approved participants, according to the regents, who are asked to approve the incentive program at a meeting, who will be asked at a meeting next week to approve it. The regents are eliminating immediately their $873,000 support for Iowa Public Radio. The public broadcaster also is projecting decreases in fundraising revenue from memberships, underwriting, and events due to anticipated economic issues related to the pandemic and no scheduled revenue-generating events. When regents during their meeting this Wednesday consider approving these cuts and the university's pared-down budgets, they won't include athletic projections, which they typically do. Due to the volatility of fall sports schedules resulting from the pandemic, the detailed athletic budgets will be considered for board approval at its September meeting, says the board. Dorm reductions. Among the self-supporting enterprises across the campuses are the resident systems at University of Iowa and Iowa State, both of which are bracing for budgetary losses this year because of fewer students who are expected not to live on campus in the fall and having no summer revenue. At the University of Iowa, anticipated occupancy has been reduced from 6,225 to 5,700, loss of about 500 students. Total revenue projections have dropped nearly $8 million, and its total fund balance projections have dropped over $12 million. Iowa State has reduced its occupancy from 10,238 to 9,464, almost 800, with the revenue expected to fall $7.7 million. The Linden and Oak Elm halls will be reserved for in-system students needing isolation and quarantine housing, according to the budget documents. Iowa State's resident system reserve funds are projected to increase due to the cancellation of previously planned improvement projects. And although University of Northern Iowa's resident system is not projecting as many losses, it's looking at nearly 200 fewer students. Iowa State took exception to a $62,000 cut to its veterinary diagnostic laboratory, which it touts as protecting animal and human health and advancing Iowa's $32.5 billion animal agriculture economy. The cuts, according to the documents, come amid soaring demand for labs' diagnostic services, and as it is being asked to submit substantial resources to the state hygienic laboratory for COVID-19 testing. Cuts to the lab line will substantially weaken the ability to prevent and respond to disease outbreaks in the Iowa livestock and poultry industry, and it will weaken the state's ability to respond to COVID-19, the documents from Iowa State state. The Iowa State Lab's caseload is the largest of any like it in the country. Turning now to page A3 inside the journal, Irving Jensen, longtime Sioux City businessman and philanthropist, has died at age 88. Local leaders remembered Irving F. Jensen Thursday as someone who loved history, his community, and combining his two passions. Jensen, a longtime businessman and philanthropist, died Wednesday night at age 88, surrounded by his family. Irving always wanted to make the community a better place to live, Mayor Bob Scott said. This was something that mattered to him. Jensen contributed to a long list of local civic, charitable, and educational endeavors during his storied career. In a 2014 interview, he told the Journal, "We learned by our history. If we don't pay attention, we will fail." A Sioux City native who graduated from Central High School, Jensen attended Yale University, where he graduated in 1954 with a degree in industrial engineering. Following graduation, he served as a lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force for 2 years and went into the Air Force Reserves, retiring as a captain in 1968. When Irving went to Yale, he could have gone to live and work anywhere in the world, Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott said. Instead, he returned to his hometown because that's where his family was from, and he had a genuine love for this community. Jensen returned home to join a Sioux City-based construction business started by his grandfather, C.M. Jensen, in 1896. The Irving F. Jensen Company, a general construction contractor that built bridges, highways, airport runways, culverts, and apartment complexes, was sold to Bismarck, North Dakota-based Knife River Corporation in 2005. In retirement, Jensen remained active in community involvement. Scott said Jensen was just as methodical in his philanthropy as he was in his business. No matter what he was doing, Irving always brought a list, Scott said with a laugh. We may not see eye to eye with everything on his list, but Irving came well prepared. Yeah, I know all about Irving's list, said Dave Bernstein, smiling. I received many of Irving's lists. Bernstein, an officer and co-founder of State Steel Supply Company and co-founder of Saturday in the Park, worked with Jensen on the preservation project to save Sioux City's historic Orpheum Theater nearly 20 years ago. The two men continued to serve together as part of the theater's board of directors. Irving loved antiques, and he loved restoring something while making it seem new again, Bernstein said. That was true of the 1918 Mack fire truck that Jensen presented to the Sioux City Public Museum on permanent loan. It was also true of the Orpheum, which began life as a vaudeville and movie palace in 1927 before going dark as a bargain movie theater 65 years later. The Orpheum was the ultimate antique, and Irving considered it to be the ultimate antique restoration, Bernstein explained. It was something the entire community could be proud of and something that everyone could enjoy. What type of entertainment did Jensen enjoy? According to Bernstein, the Sioux City Symphony, and surprisingly, singer-songwriter Jewel. I was supposed to have dinner with Jewel when she played at the Orpheum, Bernstein said. I was called away, but Irving took my place. He enjoyed Jewel's company and loved her show, even if he couldn't remember her name. Shortly after he died Wednesday night, the Orpheum's marquee was illuminated with Jensen's name and the years he was born and died. As he was in all other aspects, Jensen was driven by details. Irving needed to know the ticket sales and the concession sales of every big act that played the Orpheum, Bernstein said. He'd ask, did we scrub? That was his way of asking, did we make money? But if Jensen ever saw an imperfection at the Orpheum, he'd tag it with blue duct tape. If there was a stain on the carpet or a scratch on the wall, Irving would spot it, drop some tape over it, and tell the building crew all about it, Bernstein said. Irving knew a 90-something-year-old building would never be perfect. He simply wanted it to be as close to perfect as possible. Morningside President Dr. John Reinders could definitely relate to that. Yes, Irv would pull out his duct tape when he saw something wrong at Morningside as well, he noted with a chuckle. More than that, Irv once saw some weeds growing on campus, proceeded to pull up the weeds, and brought it to my office personally. Nevertheless, Jensen remained a dear friend of Reinders, in addition to being a member of Morningside's board of directors for more than 20 years. Jensen was also generous with his support of the college. In 2006, Morningside's Elizabeth and Irving Jensen softball complex was named after his parents. In August 2019, the Irving F. and Carolyn B. Jensen Press Box at Elwood Olsen Stadium was named in honor of Jensen and his wife. Education was so important to Irving, Reinders said. It was something he truly valued. Sioux City Community School District Superintendent Paul Gaussman can vouch for that. For more than 15 years, Jensen helped pave the way for 8 to 12 teachers to attend the Teachers Institute in Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia. It wasn't just Sioux City District history teachers who got extra training, Gaussman said. Irving extended that offer to history teachers in surrounding areas as well. Gaussman said Jensen's reasoning was sound. Irving said, other than the Native community, we are a nation of immigrants, Gaussman said. If we don't teach history well, we won't be good citizens. That means the nation couldn't go forward. Irving was always looking towards the future, Gaussman added. We lost a giant in the community with his passing. Reinders said he also lost a cherished friend. Irving made everyone feel special, he said. Irving was a charitable man and a good man. Bernstein remembered plenty of discussions with Jensen that began with Orpheum-related business and ended in a very different place. I had so many wonderful conversations with Irving over the past few decades, he said. Irving really was a classic gentleman. Services for Jensen will be held at 1 p.m. Monday at the Orpheum. A private burial will take place in Logan Park Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial. More local news is that Morningside College semester will end by Thanksgiving and masks will be required in all buildings. Morningside College officials have set details to safely bring back students for the fall semester during the novel coronavirus pandemic, including delivering instruction in in-person fashion, finishing courses by Thanksgiving, and requiring masks in all academic buildings. Morningside officials announced the plans Thursday. As College President John Reinders said, monitoring the pandemic remains a fluid situation, so plans could change at the Sioux City institution. Taking care of one another is always a top priority here at Morningside. 2020 has only underscored the importance of that priority. We are committed to doing our best to protect students and our campus community, Reinders said. Since March, Woodbury County has had nearly 3,500 reported cases of the coronavirus, and 47 county residents have died from COVID-19. The start of the year is being moved up by 1 week to August 19th in order to finish classes by Thanksgiving, which is a step some other regional colleges also are taking. Face masks will be required in all academic buildings, in the hallways, stairways, and elevators, in other Morningside buildings, and in the Olson Student Center, except for the cafeteria where students eat. They will also be required in the common areas of dormitories, but not in individual rooms. The summary from Morningside says, do your part to practice physical distancing and use of face coverings to respect fellow community members. Practice good hygiene throughout the day, including frequent hand washing. If coronavirus spread necessitates it, Morningside instruction will shift to online or a hybrid of in-person and online. For now, the plans say faculty are preparing to begin coursework in person. Students with medical or administrative exemptions from in-person learning will have options to complete coursework remotely. By comparison, in another college story in Sioux City, Briarcliff University will begin the fall semester as planned on August 24th with a new schedule that has online elements, does not include Friday courses, and requires students and college employees to wear face masks on campus. Also in Sioux City, Western Iowa Tech Community College offers for the fall semester include both online and flex courses. Flex courses will combine face-to-face, online, and Zoom learning, with instructors delivering as much content as possible in the traditional classroom setting. Face coverings will be required. In a related story, the University of South Dakota will require face coverings inside campus buildings this fall. The University of South Dakota will require face coverings in all public indoor spaces on campus when the academic semester begins August 19th. The move was announced by the South Dakota Board of Regents Wednesday as a part of their response to the pandemic. The college announced last month that fall term classes would end by Thanksgiving and that final exams will be taken remotely. The new protocol applies to students, faculty, staff, and visitors, and will be in effect for the state's six public universities, according to a press release from the college. Face coverings may include a mask, bandana, shield, or any covering that covers the mouth and nose. USD's new face covering requirement coincides with an announcement by Morningside College officials that you just heard about, which requires masks in all of Morningside's academic buildings. Clay County, where University of South Dakota is located, has sustained a lower level of COVID-19 infections than some others in the region, including Sioux City and Woodbury County. To date, 101 people in Clay County, South Dakota, have tested positive for the virus. 89 are now considered recovered, according to the South Dakota Department of Health. That Department of Health will review the new protocols 30 days after the start of the fall term. Significant community spread of the coronavirus in certain areas of the state or other special circumstances may result in an individual campus or location operating at a different level within the tiered framework from other institutions there in South Dakota. It appears there are no letters to the editor today, but an opinion from the Lincoln, Nebraska Star is just as appropriate here in Iowa, and that is: districts are best equipped to make decisions about opening their schools. There were rumblings earlier this month that the federal government might pressure school districts to reopen by threatening to withhold funding. Trump tweeted on July 8th, "In Germany, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and many other countries, schools are open with no problem. The Dems think it would be bad for them politically if U.S. schools open before November election, but it's important for the children and families. May cut off funding if no open." The day before, U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos didn't give Fox News Tucker Carlson much in the way of specifics, but her message was similar and obvious. Schools must fully reopen or else. Nebraska's Education Commissioner Matt Blomstedt said the state wouldn't be changing any of its guidance for local schools based on federal threats. The Nebraska Department of Public Education has been working with local school districts for several months to safely provide community and continuity of learning for all students in the state, he said, adding that the department will continue to support thoughtful local leadership as they develop their individual plans to safely return to school. Thoughtful local leadership and individual plans are two very important phrases. The end of the scourge of COVID-19 won't happen nationally. It will happen one state, one county, one community at a time. What needs to happen to safeguard the 70 or so students who attend the McPherson County School District's two schools will be very different from the Omaha Public Schools must do to protect its almost 53,000 students at their 106 schools, or Lincoln with 42,000 students in 72 schools. Locally, students, parents, teachers, and staff and administrators might have questions about plans and policies, but no one is better equipped to address them than local leaders. And the state, thankfully, seems to understand that. Can't say that for Iowa. We advocated for local control for counties reopening their offices when Governor Pete Ricketts tied the condition of not wearing masks to receiving CARES Act funding. The stakes are higher and the risks greater as school districts move toward reopening in one fashion or another within a month, even as COVID-19 cases are surging in places that have seemingly eased restrictions too soon. School districts have hard decisions to make. The last thing they need are threats or interference from the federal level. The first thing they need is guidance and support geared toward each district's unique situation. And that's certainly true here in Iowa, but Governor Reynolds doesn't seem to get it. In virus news, Sioux County has recorded a COVID death. Sioux County this week sustained its first known COVID-19 death, while Dickinson County virus death toll rose to 4. The ages of the deceased are not known. Sioux City, Sioux County has the third highest COVID-19 tally in Northwest Iowa with 548 known infections to date, while Dickinson County is the fifth most impacted with 350 known infections. Sioux County was one of the first counties in the region to have residents test positive back in March. The majority of the positive cases in both counties, 446 in Sioux County and 235 in Dickinson, are now considered recovered. The Sioux Land District Health Department also tallied two new COVID-19 infections Thursday in Woodbury County, while the health department in neighboring Dakota County tallied only one. The number of new infections reported daily in Woodbury County has ticked upward slightly in recent weeks, as has the positivity rate, which is the number of tests that come back positive, though it has ebbed and flowed somewhat. Dakota County's new infections have largely held steady, with fewer than 10 most days. Since the beginning of the outbreak, 3,510 people in Woodbury County have tested positive for the virus. Of these, 3,160, almost 90%, have allegedly recovered. The percentage of recoveries has trended downward somewhat recently as the number of new infections picked up. In Dakota County, nearly 1,900 people have tested positive since the outbreak began. Majority are likely recovered, but Dakota County Health Department doesn't release official recovery data. Plymouth and Sioux counties had a somewhat larger tally on Thursday with 6 and 7 new infections respectively, while Buena Vista County logged in with 5. Other counties in northwest Iowa tallied 1 or 2 or 0 as of Thursday. In southeast South Dakota, Union County recorded 2 new infections, while Clay County tallied 1 and Yankton County had 4. Thurston County in northeast Nebraska, which has been most impacted other than Dakota County, logged 4 new infections on Thursday for a total of almost 200 since the outbreak began. No new infections were recorded in Dixon, Cedar, or Wayne counties. 4 outbreaks are ongoing at long-term care facilities in northwest Iowa. At the Good Samaritan Society in George, 11 residents and staff have tested positive. 2 are considered recovered. At Good Samaritan Society in Newell, 13 have tested positive, and 11 are believed to be recovered. At the Good Samaritan Society in Lamars, 11 have tested positive. Of these, only 1 is considered recovered. At the Touchstone Healthcare Community in Sioux City, 20 have tested positive, and only 2 are considered recovered. Long-term healthcare facilities in Iowa have been a major source of the state's COVID-19 deaths, representing 441 of the state's 820 total deaths. A total of 21 long-term care facilities across Iowa are currently experiencing outbreaks. Across northwest Iowa, a total of 11 COVID-19 patients are currently in the ICU and 4 are on ventilators, which comes from the Regional Medical Coordination Center statistic. You're listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, July 24th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First is from Sioux City. Janice Bucky Byers, 75, of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, July 23rd at her residence. Services will be 1 p.m. Sunday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel with Chaplain Kathy Yoder officiating. Private burial will be in Lincoln Memorial in Lincoln, Nebraska. Visitation with the family will be held 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home, and online condolences can be left on the Meyer Brothers website. Janice was born on March 28, 1945, in Rugby, North Dakota, the daughter of William Edward and Eunice Sarah Smutzler. She married Don Byers on March 6, 1992, in Sioux City. Janice worked as a bartender for various establishments. She loved her family and enjoyed keeping up with all of the family's activities. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. From Sioux City, Jeffrey Scott Schultz, 54, of Sioux City, passed away on January 30th at a local hospital due to complications from an unexpected illness and COPD. The celebration of life will be 1 p.m. Saturday, September 5th, at the Stone Lodge in Stone State Park in Sioux City. All friends and family are welcome to attend and share memories of Jeff's life. Jeff was born in Sioux City on June 14th, 1965. The son of Gerald and Sherry Schultz, Jeff graduated from West High School and worked at several area businesses, including Gateway and Cuddy's and Curly's, mostly in the maintenance field. Jeff had a very kind and gentle nature and was a friend to all who knew him. Jeff had a great sense of humor and loved spending time with friends and family. Jeff was especially loved in the Crescent Park neighborhood he grew up in, often referring to himself and friends as the Crescent Park crew. Jeff enjoyed spending time outdoors, riding his bike, listening to music, cooking, and caretaking. Jeff loved playing and watching all kinds of sports and could always be found cheering on his beloved Indianapolis Colts football team or showing off his awesome foosball skills with his friends. Jeff will be remembered for his big heart, fun-loving spirit, and a smile and laugh that could light up the room. We're proud to say that Jeff's wish to be an organ donor was also honored, and he will live on in others. From Sergeant Pluff, Maxine J. Wolverton, 90, died Tuesday, July 21st. There will be private memorial services at a later date. The Rush Family Care Service of Ottawa is in charge. And as noted earlier, Irving F. Jensen, Jr., 88, died Wednesday, July 22nd. Services are July 27th at 1 p.m. at the Orpheum Theater in Sioux City. There will be a private burial in Logan Park Cemetery. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is in charge. From Orange City, Stanley L. DeHaan, 90, died Wednesday, July 22nd. Services are the 25th tomorrow at the American Reformed Church in Orange City. Burial will be in West Lawn Cemetery. Visitation is July 24th from 4 to 6 p.m. Ullman Funeral Home of Orange City is in charge. And from Sioux City, Travis L. Gutierrez. On Monday, July 13th, 2020, Travis Lee Gutierrez of Sioux City, loving father of Magdalena Joe, passed away at the age of only 31. Memorial services will be 6 p.m. Monday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Visitation will be 4 to 6 p.m. Monday at the funeral home, and online condolences can be left on its website. Travis was born on May 15, 1989, in San Bernardino, California. Travis worked as a bartender at his family's business, the Court Street Tap, where he made numerous friends that became like family, known as the Courtyardigans. He enjoyed watching Minnesota Vikings football, Twins baseball, and playing pool and darts. He loved fishing and spending time with his family. He would often drive his grandmother to Elk Point to have lunch with his great-great uncle and aunts. Travis was fond of listening to their stories about the old times. Travis and his daughter, Magdalena, have spent the last 7.5 years going to parks, the Omaha Zoo, the Children's Museum, and Explorers and Muskies games. They enjoyed getting pedicures together and prank calling friends and family. Travis and Magdalena love telling each other bad jokes. The best memories are going together out to eat, making someone's day by paying the ticket of another table near them. Travis was loved dearly and will be missed by many. For those wishing to share a memory, photos, or a dad joke, an email account has been set up for his daughter at lenabena15@gmail.com. All submissions will be reviewed before being shared with his daughter. And from West Lafayette, Indiana, but formerly of Sioux City, Jane Elizabeth Pritchard, 72, of West Lafayette, formerly of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, June 30th at her residence. Memorial services will be 2:30 p.m. Thursday, July 30th at the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, 1201 Clifton Avenue in Sioux City. You may sign the guest book and leave memories at SoilerBaker.com. Jane was born July 11th, 1947, in Sioux City, to the late Guy and Viola Hoff Todd. Jane received her undergraduate degree from the University of Nebraska and her master's degree from the University of Northern Colorado. On June 12, 1993, she married William K. Pritchard in Lamar's, and he survives. Jane was an elementary teacher in the Kingsley Pearson School District before teaching 27 years as a special education teacher Cluckhone School in Lamar's. She was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints and Delta 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 Sorority. Jane enjoyed family, traveling, reading, quilting, and genealogy. From Lawton, Iowa, Garrett J. Fryman, F-R-I-M-A-N-N, only 18, died Tuesday, July 21st. Memorial services are July 29th at 4 p.m. at Country Celebrations in Sioux City. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is in charge. From Marcus, Iowa, Joan Thiessen Cronin, 92, died Thursday, July 23rd. Services are July 28th at 10:30 at Holy Name Catholic Church in Marcus. Burial is in Holy Name Cemetery. Visitation is July 27th from 5 to 7 p.m. Greenwood Schubert Funeral Home of Marcus is in charge. From Sheldon, Iowa, formerly of Anton, Iowa, Deborah A. Dixon, 61, died Wednesday, July 22nd. Services are July 27th at 11 a.m. at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Anton. Burial will be in Mount St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery. Visitation is July 27th at 10 a.m. at the church. Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Anton is in charge. From Sioux City, K.A. Lau, L.A.U., 80, died Wednesday, July 15th. Graveside services will be July 27th at 1 p.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery. Nelson Berger Northside Chapel is in charge of the services. And finally, from Sioux City, Lucinda Cindy Baker, 60, died Friday, July 17th. Graveside services will be July 27th at 1 p.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery. And again, Nelson Berger Funeral Home is in charge. Well, here's some health advice from the health and family section. Focus on the top blood pressure number. The question is, the bottom number of my blood pressure is always less than 80. Does that mean I need to be less concerned about the top number? Well, the answer is this. When doctors started paying attention to the dangers of high blood pressure in the middle of last century, experts recommended focusing on the bottom number. That's the diastolic blood pressure, pressure in your blood vessels when the heart is at rest. The top number was pretty much ignored. That's called the systolic pressure, which reflects the force produced by the heart when it pumps blood out to the body. So treatment for high blood pressure, hypertension, was aimed at keeping the diastolic pressure under 90. People who had only a high systolic reading did not routinely get treatment for lower blood pressure. In the 1980s, new research showed the importance of both the top and bottom numbers, and then more studies suggested that a high systolic pressure might pose a bigger threat to health than thought. Indeed, most studies have shown a greater risk of stroke and heart disease related to a higher systolic pressure compared with elevated diastolic pressures. That's especially true in people ages 50 and older, which is why doctors tend to monitor the top number more closely. The reason for the difference in risk may be related to the force put on the arteries when blood rushes out of the heart. In 2017, new guidelines from the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, and 9 other health organizations lowered the numbers for the diagnosis of hypertension, or high blood pressure, to 130 over 80 millimeters of mercury and higher for all adults. The new guidelines also recommend checking your blood pressure often, ideally with a home monitor. The readings provide a more accurate reflection of your readings compared with the occasional blood pressure measurement in the doctor's office. Armed with better data, you and your doctor can make more informed decisions about ramping up lifestyle changes or medication adjustments. Today we know that just like cholesterol, lower blood pressure, both systolic and diastolic pressure, is healthier. But when deciding when and how to treat high blood pressure, doctors' primary focus is now on the systolic pressure readings, which are the top number. And allegation that President Donald Trump's envoy to Britain made inappropriate remarks about women and minorities may have violated federal ethics rules and roiling the U.S. Embassy in London. Current and former U.S. officials say the charges against U.S. Ambassador to the Court of St. James, who is Robert Woody Johnson, surfaced during a routine inspection of operations at the embassy, and are to be addressed in a report by the State Department's Inspector General. Those officials say Johnson is accused of making insensitive remarks that contravene department personnel guidelines. But perhaps more seriously, Johnson's former deputy has alleged the ambassador tried to intervene with British government officials at the president's request to steer the British Open golf tournament to Trump's Turnberry Resort in Scotland. And Obama blasts Trump in a video. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and former President Barack Obama stepped up their attacks on Donald Trump and defended their time in the White House in a new video showing that their first in-person meeting since the coronavirus outbreak began. The 15-minute video, posted online Thursday, is the latest effort to get the former president more involved in the 2020 campaign as the former vice president tries to rebuild Obama's winning coalition. Obama has promised an active role on the campaign trail this fall. The former White House partners used an interview-style conversation to amplify Biden's arguments against Trump, with Obama emphasizing Biden's experience and personal attributes. They pointed to their administration's 2010 health care law and blamed Trump for stoking division among Americans. They also were sharply critical of the Republican president's efforts to combat the coronavirus, which has killed more than 140,000 Americans, and which he has called a Democrat hoax. And in fair housing, the Trump administration said Thursday it will revoke an Obama-era housing regulation designed to eliminate racial disparities in the suburbs, a move that fair housing advocates decried as an election year stunt designed to manipulate the fears of white voters. And Confederate names. The Senate on Thursday, that's the U.S. Senate, joined forces with the House in defying a veto threat from Trump to approve defense legislation that would remove the names of Confederate officers from American military bases such as Fort Bragg and Fort Benning. And there was a confrontation in Congress as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's outrage over a Republican lawmaker's verbal assault broadened into an extraordinary moment on the House floor Thursday, as she and other Democrats assailed a sexist culture of accepting violence and violent language against women, whose adherents include the President, Donald Trump. Wall Street saw yesterday slumping stocks across most of Wall Street and sent the S&P to its worst loss in almost 4 weeks, and undercut a report showing that the layoffs are picking up across the country with coronavirus counts. And pardons. House Democrats tried to rein in President Donald Trump's clemency powers on Thursday as they advanced legislation that would discourage pardons for friends and family and prevent presidents from pardoning themselves. The bills are unlikely to pass Mitch McConnell-led Senate. And in a Nazi trial, a German court on Thursday convicted former SS Private Bruno Day, who's now 93, of being an accessory to murder at the Stutthof concentration camp, where he served as a guard in the final months of World War II. He was given a 2-year suspended sentence. And there will be an inquiry in Portland as the watchdog will review the federal agents' conduct as they raided in Portland. Two government watchdogs said Thursday that they had opened investigations into the conduct of federal agents responding to unrest in Portland, Oregon, following abuse of power allegations by members of Congress, local officials, and the public. The Justice Department watchdog said that it would investigate use of force allegations in Portland, while its counterpart at the Department of Homeland Security said it would examine whether officers from the agency improperly detained and transported protesters in the city last week. The Justice Department is also examining the training and instruction provided to the federal agents who responded last month to protest activity at Lafayette Square near the White House. Among the questions being studied are whether the agents follow department guidelines on the use of chemical agents and less lethal munitions. Meanwhile, the standoff between demonstrators and federal police dispatched to Portland, Oregon, dragged on Thursday after the mayor was tear-gassed by federal agents as he made an appearance outside a federal courthouse during raucous protests. And Governor Tim Walz signed a police accountability bill into law Thursday that includes a ban on neck restraints like the one that was used to kill George Floyd in Minneapolis. And we have time for some sports news. Sioux City East's baseball team fell to number one Johnston in extra innings yesterday. Number one ranked Johnston had to fend off a determined East squad before recording a 6-5 win in 8 innings in Class A Class 4A sub-state baseball final. The Black Raiders twice overcame deficits and bounced back from a 3-run hole to force extra innings, but failed to get a runner on base in the 8th inning. The Dragons loaded the bases and scored on a 1-out squeeze bunt by Jacob Wolver to end the contest and earn the state tournament berth. Johnston's Parker Shoup hit a grand slam in the 4th inning to turn a 2-1 East lead into a 5-2 advantage for the Dragons, but it wouldn't be until the 8th inning before they could score again. In the meantime, the Black Raiders were far from done, scoring single runs in the 5th, 6th, and 7th innings to tie the game at 5-5. East got one run back in the 4th inning due to some defensive sloppiness by the Dragons. Chase Patterson led off the frame with a single, then advanced to second on a ground out and a third on a wild pitch before scoring on an errant pickoff attempt. A solo home run by Alec Patino to center field to lead off the 6th closed the gap to 5-4 going into the 7th inning. East then tied the game at 5-5 in the 7th when Bennett Vanderloo, who lined a 1-out double to right field, came around to score on a wild pitch with Carl Reamer batting and 2 out. The Black Raiders had scored twice in the 3rd inning to take the 2-1 lead. Cale Boover led off the frame with a single and scored on a bases-loaded walk to Patterson. Tarek Thompson, who had reached on an error, gave East the lead when he dashed home on a wild pitch to score the 2nd run in the inning. East missed several chances to open the game up in the early innings, stranding 2 runners on first and had the bases loaded in the 2nd and 3rd innings. Reamer was a starting pitcher for East and held the Dragons to 1 run through 3 innings of work. Beaver was the final Black Raiders pitcher and worked from the 5th inning before laboring in the 8th, walking 2 batters and hitting another to load the bases ahead of the winning bunt. East ends its season with an 18-6 record, while Johnston moves on with a 21-3 mark. And for you Minnesota Twins out there, they have placed star pitcher Odorizzi on the injured list. The Minnesota Twins set their opening day roster on Thursday with right-hander Jake Odorizzi on the 10-day injured list due to mild soreness in his upper back. Rich Hill will take Odorizzi's place the first time through the rotation and is scheduled to start on Saturday in Chicago against the White Sox. Jose Berrios will take the mound for the opener tonight, with Kenta Maeda set for Sunday and Homer Bailey on track for the next week. Manager Rocco Baldelli said he expected Odorizzi to throw a bullpen session at some point during the weekend. The 2019 All-Star will be eligible to rejoin the active roster on July 30th. With an off day on Monday, the Twins might not need an additional starter before Odorizzi is cleared. Backup catcher Williams Astudillo, who tested positive for coronavirus upon his arrival at camp and has yet to work out with the team, joined Odorizzi on the injured list. Center fielder Byron Buxton, who suffered a left midfoot sprain on July 13th, was also included on the 30-man roster and expected to join the Twins in Chicago. The biggest surprise on the opening day was the addition of Australian rookie outfielder Aaron Whitefield, who is a speedster and finished last season playing in double-A ball. Major league rosters must be trimmed to 28 players in 2 weeks and then 26 players 2 weeks after that. And the Chicago Cubs placed left-hander Jose Quintana on the 10-day injured list on Thursday because of nerve damage to his pitching thumb that was suffered before the start of summer camp. The 31-year-old Quintana wasn't expected to be ready for opening day after cutting himself washing dishes at his home in Miami last month. He underwent surgery July 2nd and resumed throwing on flat ground after his stitches were removed just last week. Quintana went 13-9 with a 4.68 ERA last year, in his second full season with the Cubs. He was an all-star for the Crosstown White Sox in 2016. The Cubs also placed infielder Daniel DeCalso on the 45-day injured list with a sprained left ankle and announced that outfielder Mark Zagunas opted out for the season. Chicago Cubs host the Milwaukee Brewers in the opener on Friday. The Minnesota Vikings have offered their coach Mike Zimmer an extension. He may not be coaching on the final year of his contract this fall after all. The Vikings were finalizing a new multi-year deal for Zimmer, according to the NFL Network, preparing to reward the seventh-year coach following his second playoff win in New Orleans in January. Zimmer led the 10-6 Vikings to a third postseason appearance in his sixth season in Minnesota last year. Zimmer, 64, is tied for the seventh longest tenured NFL coach, behind only Bill Belichick, Sean Payton, Mike Tomlin, John Harbaugh, Pete Carroll, and Andy Reid. Under Zimmer, the Vikings are 57-38-1, which is a 5.99 winning percentage in the regular season, and 2-3 in the playoffs. If an extension is finalized this week, it will happen as Vikings players begin arriving at the team headquarters for the start of the season. Rookies, quarterbacks, and select other players are expected on Thursday. And, of course, the big news last night was that the Dodgers ace Clayton Kershaw was put on the injured reserve list because of a back issue hours before he was scheduled to start last night for Los Angeles against the San Francisco Giants. Manager Dave Roberts said Kershaw's back stiffened up in a weight room workout 2 days ago. The three-time National League Cy Young Award winner had been set to make his ninth opening day start. Kershaw was being replaced by 22-year-old right-hander Dustin May, the first Dodgers rookie to start an opening day since Fernando Valenzuela in 1981. And I guess one more story here is that the Blue Jays from Toronto, who can't play in Canada, have talked with the Baltimore Orioles in the state of Maryland about using the Orioles Park in Camden Yards for their home games. The Blue Jays are looking for a major league park after the Canadian government declined to allow them to play in Toronto this year. Well, that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, July 24th, 2020. I've been your reader, Alan Fredergill, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dweebar, creator and curator of the World's of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Duber, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dweebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.